Thank you, Jennifer. My name again is Eddie Grime, president of the Kansas City Lawyers Chapter. What we always do at the beginning of this conference is we give you a little bit about what the Federalist Society is. And one reason we do that is that this meeting is open to the public. We ask for registrations, but this is for anybody. And it's for members of the media as well. We always invite members of the legacy and new media, everybody who wants to attend. And the reason we do that is that the Federalist Society, you know, we are not a lawyer's club. We are not an advocacy organization. You know, you see all these amicus briefs and the big cases of the day, including cases on some of the things we're going to talk about today. You'll never see a Federalist Society amicus brief because we don't take positions on legal issues. Instead, this group was founded as a sort of debating society. And why would you do that? Well, a group of students at Harvard and Yale and University of Chicago, and I'm missing my notes, I'm probably dissing a founding school, I just can't remember. But their thought was the best way to support the rule of law and federalism and an original construction of the Constitution at that time in the early 80s, given the legal environment, given the political environment, is to discuss. You know, let's get these issues out in the open. Let's hear both sides of the debate, and let's let people think for themselves and decide what, you know, what, how should we approach these jurisprudential issues. Now, over time, this group has blossomed. There are chapters at numerous law schools, there are numerous lawyers' chapters. That's who's actually putting on this event here today, is the lawyers' chapters. And there are even subject matter practice groups at the national level. And so a few people here are on the committees for those. I think Steve Davis is on the property rights one. I'm on the First Amendment one. So there are a lot of ways to get involved. And if you come away from this and asking yourself, you know, or intrigued by something that you hear here, you know, I encourage you to either get involved with your local lawyers chapter. That's a great way to kind of move into the society. But the other thing you can do is you can submit blog posts, you can submit white papers, and they will be published by the Federalist Society at national level. So there are a lot of ways for lawyers to get involved, and I encourage you to do that, and I encourage you to identify other lawyers in your circle, at your firm or your company, or just in your community. Bring them in, because we want their voices and we want their participation. Okay, so thank you. Without further ado, we're going to jump right into our first panel on big tech. So I'd invite our other panelists to come on up here. I'll make the introductions. We have a lot of unused name tags out there still. I think some people might have celebrated the Chiefs win last night. Had a little hard time driving down I-70 to get here. Okay, I've already introduced myself. Let me start. I will tell you, we're missing one of our panelists today. Dean Larissa Lidsky of the Mizzou Law School. We were really excited to have her here. She is a First Amendment scholar, and she's written on these issues. Unfortunately, when we had our prep call on Friday, she was in Spain. She was quarantining there due to some kind of COVID situation. She's got back in the United States, back and kissed the soil of our country, I think, yesterday. But she is has had a rough couple of days of it, so she's not able to join us here. We do hope to have her back. She wants to come to an event here, so I told her we were rooting for her just to get back to the country. Okay, without further ado, our first panelist, Amy Pakoff, is the Chief Policy Officer of Parler. After managing a Sam Goody store at age 19, she entered college and earned a trio of degrees, all of which she draws upon in her work for Parler. Math and Applied Science, Bachelor of Science from UCLA, got her law degree from UCLA, and she switched over for some reason for her philosophy degree from USC. After completing her doctorate, she taught at UT in Austin, UNC Chapel Hill, and the U.S. Air Force Academy, Colorado Springs. She also taught at Chapman Law School and Southwestern Law School. She published frequently cited academic articles on privacy law. She's right in the thick of that right now, as well as op-eds in leading newspapers across the country on a range of issues. In 2011, she began podcasting and has appeared several times as a guest on Tucker Carlson, commenting on political policy issues. Just before joining Parler, which was in 2019.
I joined 2020.
Mm-hmm. Okay. She founded and was president of the Center for the Legalization of Privacy, which submitted an amicus brief in U.S. versus Facebook in 2019. That brief, relying upon Peikoff's novel theory of the third-party doctrine, argued that the settlement order between Facebook and the FTC gives both the FTC and DOJ unconstitutional, warrantless access to Facebook user data. That may come up today. We'll see. Okay. Josh Devine, chief counsel to U.S. Senator Josh Hawley, where he oversees legal issues, manages all matters relating to the Judiciary Committee, and develops tech policy. It's quite a portfolio. Before working in the Senate, Mr. Devine was Deputy Solicitor General for this state, where he helped supervise the state's appellate docket. In that role, he regularly argued before the Eighth Circuit and the Missouri Supreme Court. Mr. Devine clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice Thomas in the 2020 term. Before that, he clerked for Judge Pryor of the 11th Circuit. He received his JD from Yale and his Bachelor of Science degree in mathematics, so we've got two math people here today, from the University of Northern Colorado. His recent legal scholarship has appeared in the Virginia Law Review and the Hastings Law Journal. One other disclaimer before we jump into it here is that both of our speakers are here in their individual capacities. They are not speaking on behalf of their respective organizations, and no one is trying to lobby the General Assembly here today. Okay. Our topic today is government regulation of big tech, and in particular, social media sites. Social media has transformed our individual lives, our culture, our society, and our politics, in both good ways and bad. There have been calls from the political left and the political right, and everything in between, for the government to act in some way to change the industry, or at least to change the rules by which social media companies operate. Why is this a matter for the government? We are not painting here on a blank slate. I'm going to quickly give some background, and I'm sure our panelists will dig into this some more. The current regime for the legal regime kind of governing big tech really arose from the background law of libel and defamation. That in turn, as many of us know, practicing this area, really just arose from the common law, which developed rules for newspapers, magazines, book publishers, broadcasters, newsstands and bookstores, and even phone companies. Specific rules evolved for handling the liability, not only the person who created and published the content, but also the person, you might call it an intermediary, who took some responsibility for distributing it or making it available to the public. Then, once we had New York Times versus Sullivan and its progeny, we had a constitutional First Amendment overlay on top of the common law rules, generally providing greater protection for speech and making it harder to sue somebody for damages for defamation. In the late 80s and 90s, courts began to grope toward a system for addressing reputational injuries arising from third-party content that was made available on electronic forums. At the same time, independent of this, many people here will remember this, there was an ongoing national discussion about the prevalence of violence, pornography, and other troubling content in video games and online, in the nascent internet. Thus was born the Clinton-era Communications Decency Act, so-called, of 1996. One portion of that statute had far-reaching consequences, dealing not with communications decency per se, but with the liability of electronic intermediaries for the content appearing on their sites. That would be Section 230, which has become kind of a household name, or I guess a household citation, if there is such a thing. I'm not going to read, this would have been a great time for a PowerPoint. I'm not going to read the section. I'll read the very first one because it's shorter. Section C1, treatment of publisher or speaker, says, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. The second portion of that basically says that if you take actions to restrict access to the availability of certain material on your website, so you're an intermediary and you provide tools or somehow restrict access to information, you are not going to be, and I'm trying to paraphrase, you are not going to be held liable on account of that action. Okay, since 1996, social media platforms have developed that engage in a wide variety of conduct. This is the second piece of this. Some merely provide hosting, and let's just consider that to be making what appears to be somebody else's content available. Now, some also, you know, you could consider that they provide recommendations regarding content. So that's an additional step. And then some go even further and provide for actual conversations to occur between users. Some social media companies do, you know, all three of those, or some combination of those. At any rate, it's fair to say, many people today argue, maybe we'll debate this, that all of this was made possible by the immunity from liability provided by Section 230. Okay, what do we do next? What's the framework for our discussion today? A part of this universe has become that social media companies do in fact censor and discriminate based on political and religious viewpoint. They also allow content that some users view as hateful or harmful. There are a wide range of ideas on whether to do anything about this, or if so, what to do. But for today's purposes, consider, we'll just call them three main positions. I might have come up with four in my notes, but yeah, let's say three main positions. Okay, first, keep Section 230, keep the status quo, in which social media companies are largely immune from civil liability and potentially from state laws that might be enacted, and we're seeing some of those, imposing conflicting duties. Not everybody agrees that that's what Section 230 requires. Put that aside for a second. And let social media companies compete for users based on the overall quality of the services they provide and on their system for content moderation. Option one. Option two, keep Section 230, but impose additional requirements on social media companies that force them to censor certain types of material, whether because it is deemed misinformation, racist, or deeply offensive. Just spoiler alert here. Okay, I don't think we have a person here to represent that position today. Although if we brought in somebody from Facebook, they might ask for that. We don't have that position today. Maybe as a devil's advocate, I'll throw it in at some point on my own. We'll see. And then third, use state action to eliminate the power of social media companies to censor based on political viewpoint. Now, there are many versions of that. Okay, one is antitrust regulation to break up the largest tech companies. Another one is treat the tech companies as common carriers, analogous to phone companies or even a parcel service, so that they are insulated from liability, from most types of liability, but in return cannot discriminate based on the content of messages. And there is a case that everybody learned in a prune yard case, a California law that you could actually compel a private shopping mall to allow leafletting and signature gathering by others. That would be consistent with this idea, this doctrine. Or third, just treat the tech companies as state actors. Either treat them as if they are a digital company town from the Marsh versus Alabama case, if you all remember that from a long time ago, or maybe on a case-by-case basis, treat them as an entity that could become subject to being found to have engaged in state action if they were subject to governmental coercion so that in a specific case, they were actually doing the government's bidding. Former President Trump has filed a lawsuit based on that theory. Finally, this is a fourth thing. You could treat the companies as public as accommodations in some way, and therefore being capable of being regulated like other forms of public accommodation. So those are some ideas. We're going to hear different spins on this from each of our speakers here. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Amy Paikoff to start, and then we'll go back and forth and take questions.
I'm very happy to be here today, so thanks for having me. Came here representing Austin. I had no side in the football game yesterday. So my goal in so much of what I've done over my crazy career is trying to avoid Big Brother from becoming a reality. And I think it's something probably many of us in this room could agree upon, although I gather it's starting to become controversial. I recently heard that the University of Northampton in the UK has placed a trigger warning on 1984. So normally I can count on consensus that we all don't want Big Brother, but maybe that's changing as well in this crazy time. Now, why, this is where I draw on my philosophy. Everything that makes human life possible or worthwhile depends on independent thought, being able to think freely and act freely. I say rational, independent thought, those are actually redundant in a certain way. If we're going to have a life at all, and certainly a good quality life, I think that requires this. And how do you have a Big Brother, and why is Big Brother a threat to this? There's two basic ways. One is with respect to privacy, and the other, of course, is with respect to free speech and free thought. And arguably today, social media companies, you could say, are already behaving like Big Brother in a certain way. This is part of the problem that we want to solve here. Social media companies, of course, United States versus Facebook and its various iterations, was concerned with the misuse of user data, right? Violating maybe even the terms of the contract between Facebook and its users, but certainly certain types of regulations having to do with how companies can handle user data. And the FTC numerous times has come down on Facebook about this. And plenty of organizations concerned with privacy have criticized Facebook privately as well. So there's that aspect. And then increasingly we are seeing censorship. And we are also seeing the larger social media platforms tell people what is and is not acceptable in terms of their thought, in terms of the viewpoints that they express, that they try to share on the sites. Any of the big social media platforms these days, I've even seen acknowledge that they will rank you based on whether you have shared certain pieces of what they call misinformation. And what was misinformation last year, for example, about the origin of the coronavirus in a lab in Wuhan, this year is seeming like maybe it's not so much in the way of misinformation. So this has been concerning. It's also been concerning that some of the so-called objectionable content or the so-called hate speech content, that seems to have a political bias element attached to it. It could be because the people working in the content moderation in these companies, they tend to lean more liberal or left or Democrat. There's been studies done on this about the proportion of Democratic donors who work for these companies, et cetera. So that could be why. So there is a problem, right? There's this issue of social media companies behaving like Big Brother. And then the question is, what do we do about it? What is the best way to solve this problem among all of the menu that Eddie laid out here? And the perspective that I want to argue for here today is that we don't want to make the problem worse. And that I see a lot of the existing problem as it stands as stemming from a relationship between government and these tech platforms that's already quite cozy. And I'll just give you one example. I don't know if you saw this press conference, but Jen Psaki, who is the spokesperson for the White House, she said that they routinely will flag for Facebook pieces of what they call misinformation. Now, if the White House is coming to you, and that, you know, the White House again has been threatening to regulate you, to get rid of the liability protection, the immunity under Section 230, threatening to break you up under antitrust, all these different things, and they say, oh, by the way, we consider these pieces of information misinformation, maybe you want to do something about it, maybe you don't, that seems like some sort of undue pressure. As I've argued in the past with respect to the consent decree between the FTC and Facebook, there is a lot of control that regulatory agencies are getting over social media companies in these sort of consent orders that aren't exactly regulation. You know, it's supposed to be enforcement, and it's supposed to be just for a limited period of time, and yet it seems to go on, and it seems to be more and more almost de facto regulation by consent order. So I think the problem is too much entanglement between government and big tech. There's also the revolving door that you sometimes hear about, that people who work for Facebook end up in government and vice versa. So too much of this. And so how do we solve it? And in my view, the best way to address any particular wrong that you can name about conduct in social media companies is to address it via a privately brought lawsuit. And I have been a vocal never Trumper, so love me or hate me for that, but I say that only because I believe that a lawsuit like the type that former President Trump did bring against Twitter and against Facebook is actually the right way to go with this. And the reason I believe that is because if you can surgically excise the particular wrong in a case without setting up a structure that's going to create further entanglements between government and big tech, and we could talk about the details of how it would work if you, for instance, made them a common carrier, or if you amended Section 230, even if you amended Section 230 to say you may not censor based on viewpoint, I think that would have inherent issues with it that would create these further entanglements that I'm concerned about. So what could you do with these private lawsuits? I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a statement in connection with the denial of certiorari in a case called Malwarebytes versus Enigma. And in that statement, he argued for just taking the existing language of Section 230 and interpreting it more narrowly. So for example, where everybody has been taking Section 230 to mean a tech platform is either a publisher or it's not. And a lot of people will say, you know, if they act as a publisher with respect to a particular piece of data, then they become a publisher across the board, right? With respect to everything that they do. That's how broad this misconception is. Clarence Thomas says, no, Section 230 does not require that you either say that they are a publisher or not and have liability either way. There's also something called distributor liability. And he argues that Section 230 should not be read so as to eviscerate distributor liability, which means that anything that the platform contributes to the content in whole or in part in its development, formulation, etc. So in particular, he has a few different types of actions. Suppose a platform actually solicits a certain type of content and says, we want an array of content on this topic. Then among those pieces of content that are solicited, they select. Maybe there's even some editing done. Maybe they add commentary. You know, if anybody is on social media, you see the little labels that they've added, different types of fact-checking labels, and the wording seems to change all the time. Sometimes they're suggesting additional material. Sometimes they're just telling you it's false, according to independent fact-checkers, et cetera. That's the adding of commentary. Sometimes the decisions that social media companies make will result in featuring certain content more prominently over other pieces of content. These are all ways that you could use the language of Section 230, and in particular, it's Section 230F3, which discusses development of content and attach liability for those things. And he's saying that this should be done. In addition to that, where the wrongdoing at stake is not just something that results from the private company that is Facebook. Everybody talks about it, it's a private company. Sometimes the private company is acting purely as a private company. Other times we're seeing this increasingly as we see this entanglement between government and big tech. You could say that a particular piece of wrongdoing has this nominally private company acting in conjunction with government in various ways. And in particular, right now, we would not have, and we don't have on the books, you know, when if there is on the books tomorrow a change in Section 230 that says they must remove what is considered legal speech, protected speech under the First Amendment, what will we have? We'll have a First Amendment challenge to that right away. So we do not have these laws on the book. What we have instead is we have the platforms doing it because either they agree with it, they think it's going to help them with respect to the threatened reform of Section 230, the threatened antitrust legislation, they want to have the revolving door keep going, whatever reason that they think they have, they're doing it even though they're not legally required to. If two thinkers who have been arguing in the last couple years who would say that this is arguably state action, if they are volunteering to behave in effect as agents of government, to censor content that could not be censored directly by government, otherwise it would be a violation of the First Amendment. If they're doing this, we could say it's a state action claim. Now, because the facts of every particular instance of this are intricate, and where do you draw the line? Where do you say that something is state action or not? I think that is exactly the type of decision that should be put before a competent judge, where all the facts are before him. He has the principle at stake that, of course, if they're acting merely as a private actor, if they are acting to distribute content and they're not developing it, then of course they should avoid liability in those ways. But I think a judge is the one who's most competent to do this. In particular, Vivek Ramaswamy, who was one of the two thinkers who did this, Judd Rubenfeld, there's a Wall Street Journal piece that the two of them wrote, published about a year ago, and then recently Ramaswamy updated it, and he said in these cases of Trump's, you have not only liability protection under Section 230, which he thinks alone creates this state action problem, you not only have carrots and sticks being put in front of the social media companies generally, but he thinks in many of these cases you have evidence that the particular bit of censorship and the particular targets for censorship were done through explicit coordination between various government bureaucrats or politicians and the company. So then he says for sure this would be a case of state action. Certainly it would seem to violate the good faith provision of 230C2, because 230C2, although it provides immunity from liability for the acts of removing content, objectionable content, that has to be done in good faith. And I would say it is not good faith if you are volunteering to be an agent of government to do what government wanted to do but couldn't because it would violate the First Amendment if it did. I don't think that is good faith. What we need to work for, I think, is to get government out of the business of picking winners and losers in any marketplace. One of the big threats that, you know, they've talked about is removing Section 230 immunity entirely, which I actually don't think the Congress has the power to do, because the principle is correct and it would be upheld in common law and in court law, even if they thought that they were going to be taking it away. Section 230 was a codification, but I don't think it's a gift of any kind. Get government out of this business. I think don't threaten them with antitrust. Don't have all these threats. And let the free market decide. Let these social media platforms act as free agents as private companies, which is what everybody says that they are. And I believe, of course, that in that situation, a platform that's operated in the spirit of the First Amendment would win out at the end. So, my position.
All right, so it's April 2020. You're on the phone with your mother, your brother, your daughter, and you say, you know, I think this coronavirus thing leaked from a lab in Wuhan. Now, suddenly your call is transferred, and you find yourself not on the phone with your mother, brother, or daughter, but with a Verizon representative who says that you have violated their terms of service. And as a result, your account is going to be suspended, and you will lose access to the cell network for 15 days. Now, this is a problem because Verizon is the only reliable carrier in your area, so you contact your congressman, only to be told, well, you know, Verizon's a private company. They can do whatever they want, and if you don't agree, if you don't like it, you can create your own nationwide cell network. Now, I think this would be intolerable for 99% of Americans. And I think the question today is really whether it should be any less tolerable when the company doing this is Facebook or Google instead of AT&T or Verizon. Now, I want to divide my remarks into a couple different categories. So I think there's actually probably a lot of agreement between Amy and I on this issue, and I want to stress the points of disagreement. I also want to argue against what I call the, you know, sort of DC libertarian view of, you know, government should never do anything. And I don't necessarily take Amy to be making that point, but you can correct me about that if I'm wrong. So I want to begin by saying the foundational principles of why government should regulate. Then I want to discuss a couple regulations that might be prudent, and finally discuss the legality of these regulations. So whenever I talk about this issue, I nearly always get the same response, which is, why should the government do anything? Isn't government the problem? Isn't government the threat to free speech? And shouldn't we just let the free market decide everything? And I think there are two responses to that argument. One, what is this abstract free market that is entirely divorced of public policy? I'm unfamiliar with it. Facebook is a corporation. It does not exist but for the laws of Delaware. Facebook relies substantially on very, very, very valuable intellectual property that itself is the creature of federal law. And of course, when Facebook enters into contracts, it relies on the power of the state or the federal government to enforce those contracts. This market that we talk about is very valuable, it's very good, but it rests on the decisions of thousands of different public policy decisions. I mean, Amy's point that we should resolve these issues through private lawsuits itself relies on the apparatus of the state to enforce our contracts, to enforce common law torts, things of that nature. So I think this government do nothing argument really just doesn't have much of a basis in the current market, and it's also fundamentally contrary to the principles on which this country was founded. So if you look back to the Declaration of Independence, you find in that first very famous clause, this idea that we have, this self-evident idea that we have certain rights. And then the very next clause says, and I quote, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. So the Declaration of Independence, what Jefferson is saying, is that in fact the whole reason we have government is because we're worried about private abridgment of our rights. That is the reason government exists. And Madison says the same thing in Federalist 51 when he says that, you know, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. What we typically forget is later on in that same essay, he says this, and I quote, "You must first enable the government to control the governed." He's talking about the same idea that Jefferson is. The whole reason we have a government in the first place is to stop private abridgment of rights. This is most obviously true in criminal law, but it's also true, you know, government has a role to play when people steal. Government has a role to play when people make promises in contract and then don't honor those promises. And yes, government has a role to play when massive, extraordinarily powerful organizations called Facebook and Google abridge free speech. So I think the question today is not whether government should do something. I think the answer to that is very much yes. The real question is, what should the government do? What is a prudent regulation? What is a prudent principled response in these sorts of areas? And I think private lawsuit just doesn't cut it for a number of reasons. I agree with probably about 75-80% of what Amy said about Section 230. I think Justice Thomas's opinion is well-reasoned and correct. But the problem with Section 230 is that it's been grossly distorted, grossly misinterpreted, et cetera. But if you fix Section 230, if you do all that, that still doesn't really get rid of the issue. Because Section 230 is a shield against liability. It's not itself a cause of action. You need something else. If Section 230 goes away, you still need something else. And there are a couple different options for that something else. I'm going to talk about a direct regulation and also an indirect regulation. So Eddie described the direct regulation pretty succinctly. I used to go to talks like this, and everybody would ask, for examples of, what's the problem? Why is there a problem? What kind of discrimination is going on? And I think at this point, most people agree that there is a problem. And if you're concerned about discrimination on these platforms, the very easy direct regulation is to just ban the discrimination. The most aggressive form that Eddie described is common carrier regulation. Facebook must carry all lawful content. This is something that we've done with telephone companies. We've done this with telegram companies. Eddie also described what I would include in the same category, but a slightly less aggressive measure, which is public accommodation laws. So you're not telling a company that they must carry everything. What you're saying is there are forbidden reasons for taking stuff down. You can't take down something because you don't like the person's race. You can't take down something because you don't like their religion. You can't take down something because you don't like their viewpoint. Now, there are 1,000 different iterations of a kind of public accommodation law, slightly less aggressive than the common carrier regulation. And then I think a third, less aggressive still version of this is to say, Facebook, you can basically have whatever terms of service you want. We're not gonna really micromanage that. But if you have terms of service, you need to enforce those evenly. We're not gonna let you draft extraordinarily vague terms of service and then enforce those in a haphazard manner against your ideological opponents. You're not gonna be allowed to do that. And I think there's merit to all of these, but ultimately, none of them are terribly satisfying from my perspective. And that's because they don't really get rid of the root cause of this issue. Now, I think there's an element in today's society that has started to oppose free speech. It's a more authoritarian element. But the vast majority of Americans still believe in free speech. So why do we not see a very large platform that carries these values? I think the reason is because this isn't a competitive industry. Instead, this is a hyper-concentrated industry. In fact, it's a hyper-concentrated industry controlled almost entirely by three people, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook and Larry Page and Sergey Brin at Google. Now, why is this? It's because of various facets of this industry. You have, Facebook has 3 billion people. YouTube, if you want a publicly available video on the internet, it's probably on YouTube. The valuable thing about these companies is not their user interface. It's not even their content moderation. The valuable thing about these companies is their size. It's their network size. It's the 21st century equivalent of the fax machine. It's more valuable the larger it is. So what this means is that these companies tend toward concentration in this industry. And they aren't really just consumer products the way a television is. They're more like digital infrastructure. And that's especially true if you're a business. I can't tell you the number of times I've had businesses from this state and others call me and say, my whole business depends on the Facebook network. And they have now suspended my account. They haven't told me why. They're not going to reinstate it. And now my business is ruined. These really are sets of digital infrastructure in many ways. And with all respect to Amy, Parler is not a substitute. If you don't like Zuckerberg's content moderation standards, there really is no comparable place to go. Leaving Facebook is not like shifting from Walmart to Target. It's more like shifting from driving to walking. So if this is the situation, then there's, we have the situation where you have a very, very valuable, very large network, and I think that's good. The problem is that you have, at least in Facebook's case, you have one single person controlling content moderation on that network. There's no reason for that. Other parts of the internet aren't like that. You know, I can email Eddie, I can email Amy with whatever email carrier I want. The email network is as broad as the internet itself, but nobody controls the whole thing. You can use whatever email server you want, and these different email servicers compete with each other. You know, maybe you like Google's algorithm, you like their text prediction, you like their spam filter. Maybe you don't like them, and so you use Outlook, or you use Apple, or you use any millions of other different email providers. That's not true with Facebook, but it could be true. What you could do is you could do an indirect regulation that would break up the monopoly on content moderation. And the way this works, the technical term for this is interoperability. And basically what it means is that a company like Facebook has to allow third parties onto its network. What this would look like in practice is that if you go onto Facebook, you can decide, you know, I really like Mark Zuckerberg's algorithm. It's a good one. It's the right fit for me. But maybe your friend decides they don't like it. They want the algorithm that filters out everything except cat videos. And the other algorithm filters out everything except that which has been prescribed as true by the World Health Organization. Or maybe you think that the World Health Organization is bunk and you want only the opposite opinions. And that's great. That would be content moderation competition. A situation where different companies get to access the Facebook network and get to impose their algorithms on top of that pipeline. I think this is what would break up the content moderation monopoly and actually give you a little bit of competition in this area. So now, why can you even do this sort of thing? Don't companies have their own First Amendment rights? And the answer to that is yes, of course they do. But this doesn't implicate those rights. Both the direct regulation and the indirect regulation are something else. They are regulations not on speech, but on property. Specifically, there are regulations on the right to exclude, the right of Facebook to exclude. And as Justice Thomas said in his statement last year, Biden against First Night Amendment Institute, this is a well-established area of law. We do this all the time. We do this with cable companies. We do it with telephone companies. Eddie mentioned the Pruneyard case. This is a pretty well-established area of law. The key here is to think of these not as speech regulations, but as property regulations. Now, I want to be clear what I'm not talking about today. I'm not talking about micromanaging small businesses. I'm not talking about price fixing. I'm talking about regulating the most powerful companies in the world. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg is more powerful than most governments. I agree with Amy that Big Brother can be both public or private. Here's what Mark Zuckerberg said about his own company a couple years ago, and I quote, "In a lot of ways, Facebook is more like a government than a traditional company." Facebook, a memo from Facebook leaked about 2 years ago in which an executive said, the executive acknowledged that they believed that Facebook has the power to alter an election. This is an incredible amount of power. Now, if you're worried about governments, if you're worried about Big Brother, count me in your company. I'm worried about that too. But if you're worried about that, you should also be worried about companies that can shut down your business. Companies that can shut down legitimate debate, and companies that think they're powerful enough to pick our government. I just want to close with this. I see a lot of suits brought by public interest law firms, you know, challenging something that the county commissioner did, or challenging something that the water district did on First Amendment grounds. And you know, I think those are important. Those cases should be brought. Those are real issues. But if we're more concerned about our county commissioner than we are about some of the most powerful companies in the world, then I think we need to reassess our priorities.
All right, well, thank you to both of our panelists here. Now, we originally discussed then before going to questions, and I've got a few, I bet I can just tell. I think there are some questions out here now. I thought we might have an initial section where each panelist could respond to the other if you have anything based on what was just said. So I will let Amy go first.
So the proposals that you are suggesting sound very interesting. I would say that any way that they are phrased or implemented is going to open themselves up to having these companies have undue pressure on them, or all kinds of pressure from government, and that this creates or perpetuates more of the problem as it exists. I think one of the reasons that Facebook is so large right now is because of government policies. For example, the lockdowns made, you know, Facebook's bottom line explode, vast expansion, because all of us were stuck communicating with other people online, et cetera. So, you know, to the extent that you could do something with respect to Facebook's monopoly that is directly traceable to the advantage that it's gotten because of its relationship with government, or that government has issued certain policies that work to Facebook's advantage, et cetera, then I would maybe address some of that, in addition to, again, surgically excising the ways in which Facebook is content moderating in conjunction with politicians, bureaucrats, et cetera. So I would favor that as opposed to a long-term entanglement. Anything that you put on the books is going to allow government to use its discretion to enforce, and that discretion to enforce is going to be a lever that it can use over these platforms. And these platforms not only are crucial disseminators of information, many of us rely on platforms like this for our news, but they are also repositories of a lot of personal information about users. And so the more entanglement you have between government, more regulation of these platforms, I think is not a good idea. I don't think it's the way to solve the problem. As for competitors, if you recall, Parler was unjustly deplatformed a year ago, just as it was set to take off. So to say that it's not possible to have a viable competitor on a free market, I think it's not fair, because, you know, Parler arguably was taken down some because of the fact that former President Trump was rumored to be coming over, and the desire, I think, for him to not be on, given the timing of the takedown. And also, I would say, in hindsight, when we see the clampdown on misinformation this last year, Parler's policy of having users think for themselves and not labeling things as misinformation, not taking them down, not throttling speech because it consists of misinformation, I think is something that the many people in certain areas of government and big tech right now disagree with. So we don't know how this problem could be solved on a free market, is what I'm saying. And if we can take surgical steps to get from here to there and let that take place, I think that's vastly preferable.
You know, I agree with a lot of what you just said, which is why I've generally restricted my remarks to the largest of these companies. I don't think we need to micromanage what Parler is doing. Now you mentioned Parler getting kicked off of Amazon Web Service, and I think that's a serious problem. Amazon Web Services is digital infrastructure. And I think the same is true for not for social media companies, but for a lot of other businesses who are on Facebook. I know so many people whose entire business relies on Facebook, whose entire business relies on YouTube. And when Facebook or YouTube makes a content moderation decision that's unfavorable to that company, you can just entirely destroy that business overnight. That's a tremendous amount of power that these companies have. It's generally the thing that we have seen as serious enough to justify regulation in the area. I'd add another comment. You know, again, I think almost all of this stems from a lack of competition in this area. And one way you can see that is just by looking at the bottom line of these companies. As a general matter, it's a little too cute of a heuristic, but as a general matter, the higher the profits of a company, the less competition in that area. And the reason is quite simple. If you see an extraordinarily profitable industry, what you do is you try to enter it so you can get some of those profits. And then when you get sort of peak competition, the profits are very small. The retail industry, the restaurant industry, those are some of the most competitive industries on the planet, and they have extraordinarily small profit margins. Facebook and Google make literally hundreds of billions of dollars a year. I don't think Google has its most recent figures from 2021 up yet, but I think it was something like $40 billion in net profit, at least in 2020. These are not competitive industries. There are, there are the reasons I said for that earlier, the tendency of these markets to concentrate. I think there are also instances of anti-competitive conduct that have come to light. Both industries have been fined billions of dollars for anti-competitive conduct. But this is ultimately a lack of competition is the problem here.
Before we move on to individual questions, I have a couple of questions. I think I'm going to ask them to Josh. I made a couple of notes in your when you were making your remarks, and maybe I'll take up somebody's question, maybe not. But I noticed you addressed towards the end the First Amendment rights that would be enjoyed by a company. And I had a note down here, Citizens United. But the other point you said is this is really dealing with the right to exclude. And I wonder, is there any problem, and I'm sure you've thought of this, but is there any problem when you think about the Hurley and the Dale cases, the expressive association cases, is there an argument that could be made by Facebook and the other companies that even though they're operating with a profit motive, that there's some form of expressive association for which the right to exclude is, one of the bundle of rights. So they're basically engaging in speech with their moderation, and those are being infringed upon. And then the other kind of related issue is compelled speech. It's kind of a cousin, that doctrine. There was no compelled speech in Pruneyard for various reasons. That turned on different factors. But here, if Facebook would be unable to actually moderate the way it wanted to based on the interoperability issue, might there be a compelled speech problem? And how would you address those issues?
Yeah, I'll take those issues and I'll add a third to it, which is that I have just advocated a position where you are limiting the right of Facebook to exclude somebody from their property. And there was a case at the Supreme Court this year that said that, the right to exclude is, taking away the right to exclude can be a taking under the Fifth Amendment. So I'd add that one as well. I would expect to see all three of those arguments made in litigation if anything I said ever came to light. And I also expect that all three of those arguments would fail for the same reason, which is that these sorts of regulations, these sorts of competition boosters, even if you do common carry, et cetera, all these things have very long historical analogs and have never been seen as violating associational rights, have never been seen as compelled speech rights, and have never been susceptible to a Fifth Amendment takings claim. And I think the reason is quite simple. We're talking about the largest organizations here, and they're at some point you switch from a situation where you've got, little niche platform that's really known for being associated with conservatives or known for being associated with liberals or what have you, into something that is much more like a digital utility. And whenever we've got to that point, which we did with telephones, which we did with telegrams, these sorts of arguments don't hold water. And that's precisely because Facebook is in the business of transmitting content. If Facebook wants to add its own disclaimers to certain content, if it wants to say, Josh Devine is saying this on Facebook and we think he's wrong, we think this is misinformation, then, I think that's probably allowed. That is Facebook's own content. That's their own protected speech. But I don't think most judges would take a look at this and say, actually, by compelling Facebook to carry everything instead of 99% of stuff, you are compelling them to speak. It's not, Facebook isn't speaking in that situation. I'm speaking, and Facebook is just being compelled to carry it, just like telephone companies have been and just like telegram companies have been.
Then you're basically destroying the ability of an entire industry to compete on different types of policies, right? So not only, I think, are you creating this entanglement that invites government to be too cozy with these companies, you are basically saying how an industry, how they can innovate. So one of the things I think that at Parler that we will in the long run win out is because we do run our platform in the spirit of the First Amendment, which means freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom of association as well, putting the tools into the hands of individual users if they want to filter out hate speech, et cetera. That's, I think, the way it should be done. And if you no matter how you write it, there is an innovator out there who could figure out a better way that social media could be done, that they would be acting privately within their rights and creating something of value for people. And I want to leave that open as much as possible. The fact that Facebook exists and might be doing wrong things shouldn't mean the destruction of an entire industry.
Yeah, I don't disagree that, putting restraints on a private business can tampen down on innovation. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm also concerned about government exercise of power. I'm very concerned about Big Brother, whether public or private. And that makes these questions very difficult from a policy perspective. You have to balance the drawbacks of exercising government power with the drawbacks of allowing continued abridgment by private power.
Okay, well, with that, we'll take questions. And I got to raise a point of order or something. That sounds like the right thing to say in this room. Do the individual microphones, are they working? Can anybody tell?
Eddie, I think
okay, all right. Well, that one certainly did something. So do we have any questions for the panelists? All right. Maybe you could go ahead and come to a microphone, or you can yell if it doesn't work. Maybe that next one. Yeah, right.
That works. So I understand we're talking about government regulation of content, moderation. But for many people, that's kind of an obscure topic and maybe one that is so policy detailed that onto it. And I'm wondering whether there's overlap to the concept, perhaps a different concept, of privacy and the right to privacy. You mentioned terms of service when you agree and you say I'm gonna use this service, the terms of service. But we talked also about, you talked about, the free market. And it seems to me that sometimes we see a failure of the free market when it comes to protecting people's rights to privacy when they agree to use any service, because people can't use services without clicking that button and getting through to what they want to do, where they agree to who knows what, anything. So is it a completely different subject, or is it accepted that in fact government does need to regulate certain things to make these services work for all of us?
I can go ahead and start. I think it's a related subject. I agree with you, it's an issue, a very serious issue. The idea that these click wrap things that we click I agree to are meaningful consent, I think, has been exposed as a lie by the last two decades. Again, I tend to see a lot of these issues as downstream from an ultimate competition issue. If you look back to the old days where this thing called MySpace existed, you had actual competition on privacy grounds between Facebook and MySpace. Facebook came out with very strong statements saying, we will not collect your data, we will not use your data, we will not sell your data, around 2007, 2008, 2009. And then Facebook reaches this tipping point where its network becomes sort of self-reinforcing and takes away nearly all the market share from MySpace. And Facebook almost overnight does an about face and becomes really, really bad on privacy grounds. I think it's a competition issue, and if you think about this as a competition issue and you do things like interoperability, things that make it easier to leave the Facebook network or to leave Facebook as the provider, then a lot of these issues will basically solve themselves.
I think there could be some cases in which you could say Facebook misrepresented what it does with your private information. And for that reason, or maybe other reasons, there should be legal redress, but I would favor private lawsuit solutions over any of the long-term regulatory entanglement solutions, again, because I have seen some of those arguably create a situation in which the government might have a nice backdoor into that data, and I see that as very dangerous.
The thing I would say in response to that is, if you're bringing a private lawsuit, you're relying on a government regulation that's creating that cause of action that you're using. So I think we can create other causes of action if we want to.
Other questions? Sure.
Well, as I understand, there are a number of private lawsuits of the type that I'm describing that are pending now, and so that we will start to see those trickle up through the courts. That is something that is not, election cycle dependent.
Yeah, I think you've seen a lot of citations of Justice Thomas's opinion in Malware Bytes. The Texas Supreme Court had an interesting opinion last June where they said, we basically agree with, I'm paraphrasing here, we basically agree with what Justice Thomas said, but we don't want to be the one to create a split in authority because this is a national industry, et cetera. So I can definitely see a lot of litigation developing in this area and maybe a court deciding to create a split of authority, maybe the Supreme Court taking this issue up. But also to push back on what you said just a moment ago, the Judiciary Committee did pass out of committee an antitrust bill just last week on a pretty substantial margin. You can never predict these things, but there is a lot more momentum in this area than there was even 2 years ago.
Other questions? Sure.
I think there's a huge role to play here. Section 230 is a big barrier in the way it's been interpreted so far. It's a huge barrier to bringing the private lawsuits that Amy is discussing. It's not clear that it's as big of a barrier or any barrier to some of the stuff that Will just asked about. When you're talking about consumer protection laws, a lot of these laws are targeting deceptive practices by these companies. When you have lied about your privacy practices, when you state in your terms of service that you allow certain content, but then you start to enforce those terms of service in an uneven manner against individuals, a lot of those things can very easily fall under the rubric of unfair trade practices. So I was encouraged to see the 48 other states hop on and join then Attorney General Hawley's efforts in this area after he became a senator. I think there's a lot of fruitful work there.
For me, when I see these suits or investigations that are brought by public entities, by government entities, I worry about what the remedies are. So, for example, in the FTC versus Facebook series of cases, what you have is an increasing level of government control over Facebook, such that in this last round where the final order wasn't given the stamp of approval by the district judge until we were well into the pandemic in spring of 2020. So I think it went by unnoticed by so many people. But there are now people who are on the board of directors or various boards in the directorate of Facebook who are appointed at the pleasure of and cannot be removed without permission of government. It's getting that serious. And so again, I'm concerned that when you have anything other than a judicial get in and excise the cancer and get out sort of approach, that you're going to have this long-term entanglement between government and tech.
Other questions? Sure. I think you got to come in. It's these middle two rows here. Or you can holler, just be loud from back there.
Taking those in order, you know, I think what's different now than was true in 2007, 2008 is the size of these networks. When Facebook and MySpace were competing, it was basically a very, very fast race to see who could get to sufficient network size that it would, what's called in the industry, tip. It becomes a self-reinforcing. Everybody wants to be on the bigger network because that's where you can reach everybody else at. Facebook and MySpace, you know, they were both very small at that time. You know, Facebook wasn't a public company. I don't recall if MySpace was, but their network sizes were about the same, and you really did have to compete. Nobody has anything close to a network of 3 billion people that Facebook currently has. Now I think it's a real serious issue worrying about entrenching these dominating players. I think GDPR, which is the regulation in the EU on privacy, has had this effect. It has had the effect of entrenching Facebook and Google. That's why I've generally favored regulations that apply only to the largest kinds of companies. This antitrust bill that just passed the Judiciary Committee last week does this. It applies maybe to, you know, 4 or 5 companies tops. You don't have to regulate these smaller companies in the same way you do these larger companies.
Well, thank you for the question, because on actually his topic, I wanted to mention that Facebook is, if you go on to, I guess, its own platform. I haven't been on Facebook for quite a long time, but if you see even on LinkedIn, you'll be fed ads telling you that Facebook supports updated regulations for the internet, or however they're putting it this week. And one of my concerns is that if there is an update to Section 230, by some miracle, there's a consensus between the people who want more removal of speech and less. I don't know how that's going to happen, but Facebook would like it to happen in accordance with its own preferred practices in this area, and I think that's a real danger. As for the use of antitrust, you know, again, I believe that we're in a situation where these giants, Facebook and Google, are as big as they are and have as much market power as they have, in part due to advantages that they got from government policies. And so, whereas normally I am not even in favor of basic antitrust law, so all of the things that you've been saying here where you say, well, it's been done forever this way and nobody's ever objected, and I said, hey, I was the one who thought Marsh versus Alabama and Logan Valley Shopping Center were wrong, okay? So that's how extreme I am on this issue. Anyway, you know, point being that even I today could see using existing antitrust law with litigation to the extent appropriate to try to redress the problem that has been created due to advantages Facebook and other big platforms have gotten from government. It is not an easy issue. It is a mess to untangle how much advantage that they've gotten, how much coordination there is between government and tech, and again, I think a very smart judge or a number of smart judges would be the best people to figure out how to solve this problem.
Well, thank you. Thanks to both of you. I'm going to make one remark here, because some of you may be having a question in your mind as we've been listening to this very interesting discussion. And then when I'm done with this remark, I'll give each panelist, if you want to take it, a few seconds for a closing pitch or remark, because we're at the end of our time even right now. But, you know, we actually made contact with someone in Facebook's moderation group. So they have a separate entity, and I don't know the exact corporate structure, but they're governed separately, and this is the entity that does the moderation for Facebook. And so they were actually available to be here remotely through like a Zoom link or something, but we couldn't do it in this chamber. We couldn't, because of the electronics and things here, we could not Zoom them in or whatever it would have been. It would have been interesting, I think, to have a Facebook perspective here to really tangle. But I wanted you all to know that we tried, and just purely for technical reasons, we didn't have them in. Okay, with that little note, final remarks, and I think, let's see, I'm trying to think, who is it fair? We'll have Josh go, and then Amy for final comments.
You know, I'm very glad they couldn't come, Eddie, because it's been fun to beat up on Facebook without them being able to respond. I think the final thing I would say is it seems Amy and I agree on at least some kind of governmental regulation here, because Amy's willing to rely on the existing causes of action that are created by government, and I think new ones are available. So really, I think the difference between our positions is a prudential judgment.
Could start a whole new debate about whether what I'm anticipating. So when I think of government enforcing rights, I think of that as different from regulation. So telling people in advance how they may or may not conduct their businesses, I think those are two separate things. But in any event, I would encourage people to explore the availability of causes of action to actually redress these wrongs. And those are things, you know, even if you think that you prefer a regulatory solution, these are things that can be worked on now, and you might see that they're going to have quite a bit of an effect. It does seem, Justice Thomas, in putting that statement out there, that there's at least some people on the Supreme Court that would be willing to hear such arguments, and I'd be interested to see this play out myself. Otherwise, I would say if you truly are concerned about this issue, one thing you can do is explore social media options and take a look and see what it looks like to see a platform that's truly run on the spirit of the First Amendment, and I think let the market decide otherwise.
Well, thank you very much to Josh Devine and Amy Paikoff for your thoughts today, and to the audience for your active participation. Thanks a lot.